This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. The first show tonight is from The Diary of Fate. The Diary of Fate was a relatively short-lived radio program that ran in 1948. I'm not sure the exact date of this particular show, Peter Drake it's called, but you can rest assured that it was in 1948. Then The Diary of Fate, the third-party narration, is done by this personification of fate itself. A rather creepy male voice. And judging from that voice, I don't really think I'd care to have my end in his hands. Peter is a rather ordinary man who could have been happy, except that for some reason he unaccountably loves his wife, Marcia. Why does anyone love anybody, huh? It rarely makes much sense. Sometimes it makes no sense, as in this case. Anyway, Marcia is grasping, greedy, ambitious, and her attitudes eventually come to infect Peter. All of which leads to Peter sitting in his bedroom with a gun in his hand.
Diary of Fate.
Fate plays no favorites. It could happen to you.
Book 84, page 327.
In the Diary of Fate.
Yes, here it is. The name, Peter Drake. Occupation, treasurer of Lewis Swerdling and Company. A comfortable life for a man of your temperament, wasn't it, Peter? A life that required few important decisions. An occupation that dealt primarily with numbers. You would have gone on in your work secure and contented. Had it not been for your wife, Marcia, she was blindly proud and avaricious. But you loved her, didn't you, Peter? Because of that love, you stand now in the bedroom of your home, the muzzle of a pistol pressed against your temple. And in less than a minute, you will be dead. Soon I will write the final entry under the name Peter Drake. When I have written, I shall read from his record in The Diary of Fate. I hope you'll understand. Yes, Peter Drake. It was your unreasoning love for your wife that forced you from the security of your world of numbers. And it was the impelling power of her greedy ambition that drove you to a grim decision. The most important decision of your life. But the ultimate outcome was determined by a little thing. So commonplace and innocent that you failed to notice it that night when you stealthily stepped into your cousin's room.
Hello, Arthur.
Peter, what are you doing sneaking in here at this hour? Why, you're drunk.
You're working late, Arthur. Are you worried?
Yes, I am. I don't know what to do.
I do. I know the answer, Arthur. And this is your last chance. I'll tell you if you'll make me a partner.
So that's why you came here. No, get out of here. Go on, get out.
Oh, no. Not yet, Arthur.
What are you doing? Stop that gun.
Since when do you keep your gun on your desk? Afraid of burglars, Arthur?
Now, Peter, please. Give me back my gun.
Sit down, Arthur. There, sit.
What are you going to do, Peter? No! No!
As you fired that shot, Peter Drake, a plan was put in motion, and the end for you was certain. At that moment, I, fate, moved unnoticed into your life. Little things. A moment's hesitation. A sudden rainstorm. A lost wallet. These are the tools with which I work. Let us turn back to the point where it all began. The country club dance. Marcia had planned on the occasion for weeks, regarded it as an important social opportunity. And yet, it was only half over, and you were on your way home.
I can't understand you, Marcia. You talk about nothing but that dance for a month, and then for no apparent reason, you want to leave in the middle of it.
No apparent reason? Are you blind?
What was the matter?
I'll tell you. Very simple life. I've never been so completely humiliated in my life. Thurman and Arthur Swoosley and their fat wives at a table with the governor. And we seated at the other end of the hall with that obnoxious Mr. Ross.
Oh, Ross isn't a bad sort, Marcia.
He's a fool. And a nobody. And so are the rest of the people at our table. Complete nobody. Our cousin Thurman's wife made certain of that.
Harriet? Don't be absurd.
She's jealous of me. She made sure I wasn't on the awards committee, nor the receiving line, nor anything else that might have put me in the public eye.
Marcia, darling, we've been over the same thing 1,000 times.
And I'm fed up with it. Sick and tired of being pushed around by the mighty Swerdling.
We've got to be patient. Uncle Lewis left the business to Thurman and Arthur, not to me.
And the poor nephew became treasurer. Remained treasurer for 6 years. You're brilliant, Peter. You're too smart to stay treasurer. You have more brains than the two of them. You should be a partner.
Please, Marcia.
Then let them try to snub and slight and look down their noses. Do something about it. Demand it. You've got to become a partner.
Yes, Peter. You felt the security of your sheltered world crumble before the insistent nagging of your wife, whom you loved deeply. You would do as Marcia asked. You had even begun to believe she was right when an hour after you arrived at your office the next morning, you boldly entered the office occupied by your cousins, Thurman and Arthur.
You left the party early last night, Peter.
Anything wrong?
No, I had a headache.
Well, too bad. Night party. Well, Peter, what do you want to see me about? That's your account?
No, Thurman, that's been taken care of. I want to talk about my position. I'm not satisfied.
What do you mean, Peter?
Just this. I want to be taken in on equal footing. I want to be up there with you and Arthur.
What are you talking about?
I'll handle this now, Arthur. Now, look, Peter. As a treasurer, you're tops. Keeping books, watching expenses, that sort of thing. That's what you're best suited for. As far as making the big deals, handling our delicate foreign commitments, well, you're still a good treasurer.
Look here, Thurman. I've made big money for this company for years. I handled our war contracts. I established our overseas trade.
Yes, you've always done your job well, Peter. No question about that. But no one man is indispensable. Now, don't forget that. And don't force my hand, Peter.
You mean you'd fire me?
Now, let's be sensible about this. Right now, there's nothing open. Arthur and I can handle the whole show. We need you. We want you. Exactly where you are. I think we understand each other. Now, is there anything else?
No, Thurman. Nothing else.
Very well. Then let's forget it.
Yes, Marcia, I talked to Thurman and Arthur. Things look much better. I'm confident that soon...
How soon, Peter?
Oh, I don't know. It all depends. They both agree my work has done the firm a lot of good.
Did they say anything specific?
Well, they said they're not quite ready yet, but
when things pick up.
Oh, Peter, they're stalling you. And they'll keep on stalling you forever. Well, I'm tired of waiting. I'm not going to wait.
What do you mean?
I mean I'm through. 6 years I've been insulted and looked down on by this word. Can't take any more. I'm through, I tell you. Through.
Marcia, you don't mean that. You can't leave me.
Peter, you're hurting my arm.
You can't leave me, you hear? I won't let you. I love you, Marcia. I love you so much that I'd do anything.
My arm, Peter.
Please, Marcia, you've got to give me more time.
You'd need a whole lifetime. Harrington and Bertha are afraid of me. They'll see that you never get in.
I will. I swear I will. But I need time. I love you so, darling. Please give me time.
All right, Peter. I'll give you 6 months. Frankly, I think it's a waste of time. You'll get into the firm only when the Swerdling brothers are dead and buried. By that time, I'll be too old to care.
Yes, Peter. Your wife had issued an ultimatum. You were forced to a decision. All that night, her words raced through your tortured mind. And by morning, you had reached your decision and established your plan. At the office, you said no more about a partnership. You did your work patiently and quietly. Several weeks went by, and when your chance came, you seized it. You had taken the monthly report into Thurman's office.
What's that? Oh, monthly report, eh? Well, thank you, Peter. Congratulations, my boy. That death of thing was a nice piece of work.
Thanks, Thurman. It did work out well, didn't it? Would you like to go over the report?
No. I'm sure it's in fine shape. You just leave it on the desk. By the way, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm all right. I've been getting a little outdoor exercise lately, and... incidentally, Thurman, perhaps you would like to come with me tomorrow.
Where?
What kind of... You used to be a pretty good shot, and I have an excellent place up on the lake.
Well, sounds great, Peter. I like nothing better. But, I've got a golf date with Larry Colpack tomorrow. Maybe some other time.
Okay, but if you have any questions on the report, I'll be in the office all afternoon.
Just a minute.
Yes, Thurman?
About this duck shoot. Can we get back by noon?
Yes, if we leave early, say about 4:30.
Fine. George, I'll do it. You pick me up at 4:30.
Fine. I'll pick you up at your house.
Good. Better sharpen your sights, boy. You're going to have to go some to beat me. I'll be gunning with a vengeance.
Don't worry, Thurman. So will I.
What's the matter, Peter? You're shivering.
I'm freezing. Aren't you cold?
Oh, I like it. It's invigorating. How'd you ever find this place? Not another soul in sight. Uh-oh. Here they come. It's your shot, Peter. Oh, you missed again.
It's this gun. There's something wrong. I can't seem to get the right trigger for you. Maybe it's these gloves.
Blame the gun, the cold, even the ducks. But never the hunter, huh? you can't get away with that. I've got four already. Take your gloves off like I did.
Don't have to. I still think it's the gun. Let's trade and see how we do. You're using the heavier shot, you know.
All right, yeah. Oh, hurry up. Here they come again.
Thurman, turn around.
Peter, stop joking. Don't point that gun at me.
I'm not joking, Thurman. I'm going to kill you with your own gun.
No, Peter, you're out of your mind. You'll never get away with it. Please, Peter, listen to me.
You thought I kept my gloves on because I was cold. No, Thurman. Only your prints will be on this gun. I'm going to blow your stomach wide open.
No, Peter, no.
It'll be an accident.
No.
Now pray, Thurman. Pray.
Yes, Peter Drake. In the cold of the morning, you killed a man. Goaded on by the whiplash tongue of the woman you loved, you committed murder. Now, Peter, the plan was finished, complete. The end for you ordained. There was no turning back. Now there are many entries to be made. Soon I will record them all in the Diary of Fate. Yes, Peter Drake. You were convincing with your story of how Thurman met his death. Only his fingerprints were on the gun. And it substantiated your story of how he held the gun by the barrel while he tapped the loose oarlock with the butt when the gun accidentally discharged. You had seen to it that the marks of the oarlock were on the butt, put there after his death, and it was marked down as another hunting casualty. And you can clearly recall shortly after Thurman was buried when you entered Arthur's office, confident that now your long-scheduled promotion was a certainty.
Arthur, why didn't you speak to me before you signed this thing? I could have smelled that trick a mile away. It's only been a month since Thurman's accident, and you get us into a jam like this.
The point is, I didn't ask you. And I am asking you now. What shall we do?
Make me a partner, Arthur, and I can give you all the answers.
This isn't the time, Peter.
Time? You're hedging, Arthur. You know as well as I do you need me here. I belong here. And the only reason I'm not is because your wife is jealous of Marcia.
You shouldn't have said that, Peter. True or not, you shouldn't have said it. If I want your advice again, I'll call you. Good day.
But if it's really that serious, Arthur has to give in, Peter. He's cornered.
Not quite. He still thinks he can find the answer alone. And if he's not a complete fool, he can.
Can't you do something to prevent that? To get him in deeper?
Juggle the books, you mean? Not a chance.
You've got to do something. We'll never get another opportunity like this. When Thurman dies, we've got our big threat. If you let this chance slip by
without... There's nothing I can do about it, so forget it.
There is a way to trap him. There must be. If you weren't such a coward, you'd find it.
You dare call me that? What do you know about courage, Marcia? Marcia, this is going to be a shock to you. But do you suppose killing Thurman was easy?
Peter.
Yes, Marcia, I murdered him. Shot him in the belly with his own gun. Now will you shut up and leave me alone?
You. Everyone said it was an accident. And all this time, Peter, you've gone this far. You can't stop now. You've got to go ahead.
No, Marcia. No, no, please.
This is our chance. Work on the book. Ruin Arthur. Trap him.
Stop it. Stop it. Stop nagging, pushing, and forcing. In heaven's name, leave me alone and stop goading me. I can't stand anymore. I can't stand anymore, I tell you.
Where are you going?
Ow! I've got to have time to think.
As you left, your mind was a turmoil of frustration. You were afraid to go on, and more afraid not to. Then, in a frantic effort to escape your thoughts, you went into a bar. The alcohol was warm inside you, and the churning in your brain quieted and finally stopped. Then you left and went straight to Arthur's house. A light burned in the library. You watched through the French doors as Arthur sealed an envelope, laid it on the mantel. Stealthily, you opened the doors and stepped into the room.
Hello, Arthur.
Peter, what are you doing sneaking in here at this hour? Why, you're drunk.
You're working late, Arthur. Are you worried?
Yes, I am. I don't know what to do.
I do. I know the answer, Arthur, and this is your last chance. I'll tell you if only you'll make me your partner.
So that's why you came here. No. Now get out of here. Go on, get out.
Oh, no. Not yet, Arthur.
What are you doing? Drop that gun.
Since when do you keep your gun on the desk? Afraid of burglars, Arthur?
Now, Peter, please. Put that gun down.
Sit down, Arthur. There at the desk.
What are you going to do, Peter? No! No!
Now, Peter Drake, you had killed again. You had murdered another man. Then you moved quickly. You wiped the fingerprints, put the pistol in Arthur's right hand, pushed his chair close to the desk, and ran from the room. You hurried to your house where you found Marcia asleep. You got into bed at once, and you knew that now, at last, he would rule the Swirling Empire. Now, Marcia would be happy. You didn't know how long you had slept before you were awakened by Marcia rushing into the room.
Peter, wake up. Have you lost your mind completely? How much do you think you can get away with?
What's the matter?
Here. It's all over the morning paper. Listen to this. Arthur Swerdling, dead. President of the Lewis Swerdling Company, was found shot to death in the library of his home late last night. Did you do it, Peter?
Yes. Yes, I did it.
Are you sure nobody saw you?
No one saw me. It all happened so fast.
What about this? Although there was every indication Swerdling killed himself, police were silent about a single clue. It indicates that someone else may have done
the clue? Oh, no, Marcia. What could it be?
Peter, listen to me. You've got to get to the office quick. Make believe that nothing has happened. You didn't see the morning paper.
A clue. If only I could remember.
Get hold of yourself. You've got to hurry.
Yes. I'm so shaky.
I'll call a cab while you dress. Hurry.
As you rode in a taxi to your office, the fatal words drummed over and over in your brain. The police were silent about a single clue. Yes, Peter, they had found something, and the cold terror of what that meant to you made your fingers tremble as you reached for your wallet to pay the cab fare. Then, for an instant, your heart stopped beating. Your wallet was missing. Frantically, you searched through all your pockets, but it was gone. The awful fact descended over you like a shroud. You ran inside and called Martha. Had her look for it at home. Her voice was heavy with fear. She told you it was not there. You had to find out. Had to know if your wallet was the clue. You decided to go back to Arthur's. And in a few moments later, as a wave of panic mounted inside you, you walked up to his door and pressed the bell.
I'm Peter Drake. I'd like to see Bertha, Mrs. Swerdling.
Were you a friend of Mrs. Swerdling?
Yes, a cousin. I'm the treasurer of the firm.
Mrs. Swerdling's pretty broken up. She said she didn't want to see anybody.
Oh, I understand, of course. May I ask who you are?
Lieutenant Fitzsimmons, police department.
Oh, I read in the paper that you men had found some sort of clue. Do you mind telling me what you found?
I really couldn't say, Mr. Drake.
I couldn't go back to the office, Marcia. Look at me. I'm shaking all over. The police wouldn't tell me a thing.
I didn't find your wallet, Peter. I looked everywhere.
Huh? What are we going to do?
Think, Peter. When did you have your wallet last?
At that bar. I must have paid for my drinks last night.
Peter, what's the matter?
That man coming up the walk. He's the waiter. The one at the bar. And look at that tall man in back of him. It's the detective. I talked to him at Arthur's.
Peter.
Sure, it's simple now. They must have found my wallet in Arthur's library. They traced my movements, and that waiter, he told him what time I left the bar.
You can get away. Run, Peter. I'll come back.
Look. Stall him, will you? Stall him as long as you can.
Where are you going?
To the bedroom. Come on, answer the door.
Mrs. Drake?
Yes?
I'm Lieutenant Fitzsimmons, police department. Like to talk to your husband in connection with the death of Arthur Swerdling.
Yeah, he's not feeling well. If you could come back.
What's that?
Peter! Oh, no!
He's dead. Killed himself.
Yes, Peter Drake is dead by his own hand. And justice has been served. Although the man is dead, I, Fate, have still another entry to make in his record. Only when the delicate scales of justice seek their equilibrium do I, Fate, move through the lives of mortals. Only when good has counterweighed evil do I rest. Remember that when the thought is born, the word spoken, the deed performed, the pen indicts. And having been written, the words are indelibly entered in the eternal ledger of the universe. Take heed, you who listen, that your decision be not for evil. For once the decision is made, there is no turning back. And if the decision be for evil, the end for you is certain. In the life of Peter Drake, the plan was set in motion with his decision. And the conclusion was inevitable. For him, self-destruction.
Suicide? Why?
Because he was cornered. Because you came after him for Arthur's murder.
What?
Yes. And he murdered Thurman, too.
Oh, wait a minute. Arthur Swerdling was a suicide. He found the note he left.
What note?
Arthur Swerdling left a suicide note on the mantle of his room. He confessed juggling the company's books. That's why I'm here. Your husband was the firm's treasurer, and I thought that...
But the clue. You found a clue.
Oh, that was nothing. It turned out to be a false lead.
No. No, you're lying. What about the wallet? He lost his wallet.
Yeah, he did that. This man just told me about it down at the door.
Yeah, lady, that's right. You see, he lost it at my bar, and I just wanted to return it. I figured it was the honest thing to do.
Now it is time to close the book. Another entry has been duly recorded on the pages of eternity. And the sensitive scales of justice are suspended in absolute balance. In the case of Peter Drake, as in the cases of all mortals, I, fate, am but the instrument. The instrument of a plan. And the little things that happen every day, the trivia of life, are the tools with which I work. It was a little thing, the innocent loss of a wallet, which, magnified a thousandfold by Peter's complex of guilt, proved his undoing. Ponder well the moral, and remember, you who listen, that there is a page for you in
The Diary of Fate.
Produced by Larry Finley. Diary of Fate is a Finley transcription. Brought to you from Hollywood.
Well, I don't know about you, but me, I'm properly chastised. I won't be killing anybody for at least 2-3 weeks, maybe even a month. Next up is a short visit to the house of the strange Dr. Weird. Hey, don't be shy. He's always home. At least he was on April the 3rd of 1945 when he told this tale. It's something about the Devil's Cavern.
The Strange Dr. Weird.
Good evening. Come in, won't you? Well, what's the matter? You seem a bit nervous. Perhaps the cemetery outside this house has upset you. But there are things far worse than cemeteries. For instance, men with murder in their hearts, as in my story tonight, a story I call The Devil's Caverns. My story, The Devil's Cavern, begins in the desolate and remote mountain country of New Mexico. It is early morning in a large hunt lodge. John Drake, the noted naturalist and explorer, is speaking to his two nephews, Victor and Paul.
You two have just wasted your time coming to New Mexico to see me. I told you both a dozen times I won't increase your allowances. And that's final.
But Uncle John, you can hardly expect Victor and myself to live on $5,000.
Now be quiet, Paul. Uncle John has always been most generous to us. If he feels that he can't give us any more, we should be satisfied.
Thank you, Victor. Dear me, it's 9 o'clock, and I'm not even at work. I must leave now.
Oh, you're going to those caverns you discovered in the mountains?
Yes. Would you take care to come with me?
No, thank you, Uncle John. Exploring caverns is hardly in our line.
But you can't go back to New York without seeing the Devil's Caverns.
The Devil's Caverns?
Yes, I call them that because they're so huge and dark. I imagine to anyone but a scientist like myself, the caverns would be rather terrifying.
I see. Well, thanks anyway, Uncle John. Perhaps some other time.
Very well. I'll see you both this evening when I return.
The old fool. Worth millions, and he wastes his time exploring caverns.
Perhaps we made a mistake in not going to the caverns with him.
What do you mean?
Last night, Uncle John spoke about finding holes in the caverns. Holes hundreds of feet deep.
What are you getting at?
Suppose Uncle John were to accidentally fall into one of those holes. You and I would inherit his millions.
Say, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I have. Yes, Paul, tomorrow you and I will accompany Uncle John into the caverns. Who knows? Perhaps he will meet with an accident.
It's just a little further to the entrance to the caverns.
But Uncle John, why did you wear leather gloves and high shoes?
Well, they're for protection against the rats in Devil's Caverns.
You mean the rats in there are dangerous?
Oh, not really. It's just that now and then one of them will take a nip at you.
Oh, whoa.
And then there's the bats. A most remarkable species. Now, here we are.
Well, you just lead the way.
It was just by sheer luck that I stumbled on the entrance.
Oh, it certainly is dark in here.
Now, just a second. I'll turn on my flashlight. There.
Well, I can understand now why you call these the Devil's Caverns. Something terrifying about this place.
Yes, and there are others even more terrifying. Come on, I'll show them to you.
Just a minute, Uncle John.
What for, Paul? Paul, why in the world are you lighting a candle?
I'm going to leave this candle here by the entrance. I think you will stop every 50 yards and leave a burning candle so he won't get lost.
Yes. The candles will serve as beacons to guide us back to the entrance here.
But that isn't necessary. Why, I know every inch of all the caverns by now. Well,
nevertheless, Uncle John, we'd feel safer this way.
Hey, well, if it'll make you feel better, now come along. There's so much I want to show you. If you'll come over here, boys, I'll show you one of those holes I was telling you about.
We'll be there just as soon as we light another candle, Uncle John.
How many candles does this make, Paul?
This is the 10th candle. I figure we come more than a quarter of a mile.
Everything's working out perfectly. Now, look back. You can see four of the candles burning, and the other six are around that turn.
Yeah. Well, come along now. We mustn't keep Uncle John waiting.
Ah, there you are. Now I'm going to show you another of the wonder of these caverns. This hole I'm shining my flashlight on.
Oh! Something just brushed against my foot.
That was just one of the cavern rats. They discovered we're here. Listen.
Sounds like there are thousands of them.
Yes, there are. Nasty little fellows, too. And our leather gloves and high shoes will protect us if they grow too bold.
I hope so.
Now, yesterday I measured the depth of this hole, and much to my amazement, I discovered that it's 920 feet deep.
920 feet? If anyone fell in, it'd be quite a fall. Shine your flashlight down the hole, Uncle John, so we can see what it looks like.
Very well. Of course, you won't be able to see the bottom, but at least you'll get an idea of how... Why are you taking my arms, boys?
We just want to make sure you don't fall in. Yes, Uncle John. After all, you're awfully close to the edge.
Nonsense, boys. I won't fall in. Now let go of my arms so I can... Stop pushing me! Come over here. Don't! I'll fall if you...
Poor Uncle John. But then accidents will happen.
Doctor, after listening to the first part of your story, don't you think some of our listeners may be a little, shaky?
Well, I can't understand why. But if they are, I suppose we ought to suggest something to, bolster their confidence.
Doctor, that's a good idea. And then there's nothing that gives a fellow more confidence in himself than correct attire. For that reason, may I suggest that your wardrobe include at least one of the many smart, correctly styled Adam hats, made of lustrous all-fur felt in a wide variety of soft, harmonizing shades. Adam hats are the epitome of fine quality and good taste. You'll appreciate, too, the distinctive hat bands and other important details of your Adam hat. Top off that well-dressed look, gentlemen, with an Adam hat. Now, back to mystery and Dr. Weir.
And now I'll continue my story, The Devil's Caverns. After John Drake's death scream had faded away, only the shrill squeaking of the rats and the heavy breathing of the two men remained. For a moment the two stood in darkness. Then Victor spoke.
All right, Paul. Turn on Uncle John's flashlight and let's get out of here.
I haven't got his flashlight. He fell in before I could take it away from him.
What? You stupid fool. I might have known you'd bungle it. Now what have we got? Wait a minute. I have my cigarette lighter, if it only works. There. Doesn't give much light, but it'll do.
Oh, come on. Let's get out of here. Place gives me the creeps.
Yes. Now, there's the first candle a few yards away. Come along.
Victor, look. That first candle just went out.
Yes.
A draft probably blew it out. Candle was right over here on this rock. Well, Victor, it's gone.
Gone? Nonsense. You probably left it on another rock. Now, let's not waste time. There's the second candle 50 yards ahead.
Oh, all right. Tell you, that was a rock I left it on. Now it's gone.
Oh, look. Second candle. It seems to be moving.
It's falling over.
It's gone out.
But that's as though someone blew it out.
Don't be a fool.
Look. The third candle's beginning to flicker.
It can't go out.
It mustn't go out. Hurry. Oh, Victor. It has gone out. Now there aren't any candles to guide us out of here.
Get hold of yourself. I've got my eye fixed on the spot where the third candle went out. Once there, we merely have to turn the bend to see the other candle.
Yes, but suppose there are two.
They won't be.
Uncle John, he's going ahead of us, blowing out the candle, so we can't escape.
How could it be, Uncle John? He's dead.
His ghost that's doing it. He's getting revenge on us for what we did.
Be quiet, do you hear?
Listen, the rats. That's it. They're the ones who are knocking the candles over. They're carrying them off. They're hungry. They're attracted by the wax in the candles.
Why are you stopping?
Can't you see? The path divides into three here. Do you remember which is the way out?
I don't remember these three paths at all.
We must have come by the middle path. Yes, I'm sure that's the one. Come on.
We're bound to find the entrance. After all the hours we've searched, we're bound to.
Why do you keep on saying that over and over? We're lost, and you know we are. We're never going to get out of here, never.
Uncle John, listen to that.
Stop talking about Uncle John. He's dead.
Dead?
No, he's all over. I can feel him. He blew out all the candles. And now he's waiting for us to die. Even the rats know that we're going to die. Listen.
My cigarette lighter. It's gone out.
Uncle John, he blew it out.
It won't work.
The fuel's all gone. Paul. Paul, where are you?
I'm over here.
You have some matches, haven't you?
Yes.
Those matches are a matter of life and death. We don't dare walk in the darkness, not with all those holes around. Paul, keep talking so I can find you.
How can you find me when I'm lost? You'll never find me, sir.
Oh, Paul, what is it?
Uncle John, he just brushed past me. He's 17.
Don't be a fool. It was a bat that brushed past you.
No. No, Uncle John. He's trying to get me. No. Not that way. Stay away.
Paul, come back. Come back, you hear? It's dangerous to run like that. Paul. Fallen into a hole. He's gone. Now I'm all alone without any light at all. So, Uncle John, you think you've gotten the better of me? Well, you have, you hear? I've got to get hold of myself. I must. If I go to pieces, I'll never get out of here. I've got to take this thing out. There must be some way that I can... Oh, my left leg. Oh, one of those rats bit me. But they're swarming all around me. Ow! I've got to fight them off. If I don't, they'll... Ow! Oh, no! Get away! Ow!
bad of our poor Victor, wasn't it? Such a horrible way to die. 2 weeks later, when a searching party entered the cabin, they found a clean white skeleton lying a few hundred yards from the entrance. Unfortunately, they were never able to find a trace of John Drake and Paul. It was as if they had vanished from the face of the earth. Now, I once knew a dead man who would... Oh, you have to go now? Perhaps you'll drop in on me again soon. Just look for the house on the other side of the cemetery. The house of Dr. Weir.
The next segment is only 11 minutes long, and is from February the 23rd of 1938. It is a story that far more people have heard of than have ever heard it. Now, it's your chance. From Lights Out, from the pen and tongue-in-cheek of Arch Obler, it's The Chicken Heart.
Do you remember some time ago, in an Eastern scientific institution, they kept a piece of heart alive for weeks on end? Well, I got to thinking, what if that heart began to grow? And grow, and grow, and grow?
Hello? Hello, operator. Give me Mr. Regan, fast. Hello, Mr. Regan. This is Lewis. Listen, get me a rewrite, man. The thing's still growing. No, Chief, I tell you the truth. The corridor's choked with living, crawling flesh. No, no, no. I'm not drunk. I'm telling you the truth. That little piece of flesh has grown until now. It's jamming that building. All inside the space of an hour. You've got to believe me. It's the greatest news story of the generation, and here you argue with me. I tell you, it's the truth. You've got to believe.
You must believe me. I tell you, the only hope is to burn the building to the ground at once.
Now, wait a minute, Doc. Wait a minute. Take it easy.
I tell you, burn it to the ground. Burn.
And I tell you, take it easy. I sent in a call.
Oh, don't you understand? For some reason, I cannot even imagine. This tissue is doubling in size every hour. Do you know what that means? In another hour, it will be twice the size it is now. And long before that, it will break open the building with the force of its pressure. And then it will be free in the street. Do you hear me? Free in the street. And then those tentacles of protoplasm stretching out to feed on anything they can reach.
What's happening?
The building! See the walls! Cracking! I warned you!
I tried to warn them. But now it is too late. The heart is free.
Gentlemen, come to order, please. Gentlemen, please. Quiet, please now. As mayor, no one realizes more than I do the necessity of immediate action in curbing this unspeakable, unbelievable emergency. And I assure you that I...
Cut the speeches, Mac. That blasted thing is spreading like a forest fire. Call the governor. Get the National Guard out.
Wait. Here is Dr. Albert of the Research Institute. Let him speak. Step up here, doctor.
Do something.
Let's see what he says.
Gentlemen, it was in my institute this horror began. And if you give me a chance, perhaps I can stop it.
What is it, Doctor? Tell us first what that monster really is.
Yes. Yes, I will tell you. That great, ever-growing mass of flesh, it is, or it was, a chicken heart.
Chicken heart? Are you crazy, man?
Yes, chicken heart, I tell you. Chicken heart. Listen to me, you fools. Left hand, left hand.
I tell you that mass of flesh was a chicken heart, the tissue of which, for some reason, is undergoing constant, rapid, accelerating growth. With every passing hour, its growth is doubling. Do you know what that means? If it is now one block in size, Within 30 hours, that cannibal flesh will have increased in size to one square block to the 30th power. In 30 hours, every inch of this whole city will be crushed under that moving flesh. Within 60 hours, it will have covered the entire state. Within 2 weeks, the entire United States. You ask for the National Guard. I say, call out the entire army. Blast this thing off the earth.
All ready, Chief. Covers are ready. All hoses coupled up. We'll flood that thing with water from all angles.
All right, here's the signal. Open them up! Full blast!
Chief! Look out! That flash is reaching out!
Get back, everybody! Everybody, back!
The fools, what good is water? I told them. The only hope is artillery. Bombs.
All National Guardsmen, report to your armories. All National Guardsmen, report to your armories. General mobilization.
Battery in position, sir.
Commence firing on the hour.
Yes, sir.
10, 5, 5, 0. Commence firing! Fire!
Useless. It has grown too large, and it grows too quickly. The flesh is already engulfing the guns. They came too late.
You all right now, Dr. Alberts?
Yes. Yes, I'm all right, Mr. Lewis. I'm all right.
Well, I sure am glad I located you. I stalled as long as I could, another 10 minutes, and we couldn't have taken off. That blasted protoplasm, or whatever it is, was sucking at the wheels by the time we left the ground.
Yes, I saw.
5,000 feet. Well, we'll cruise around up here for a few minutes and then head west.
It will do no good.
You can't mean it. It must stop growing sometime. It must.
Look at it down there. The gray blankets of evil covering everything. See how the roads are black with men and women and their children running for their lives. See how the protoplasmic gray reaches out and engulfs them. See.
Stop it! Stop talking like that. We'll get away. The government, they'll send bombing planes, poison gas.
No hope. Listen to me, Lewis. You remember only a handful of days ago you asked me my prophecy of the end of the earth? You remember my answer? Oh, such a scholarly prophecy. Cessation of earth rotation. Mighty sounding astronomical theories. But now, this is reality, Lewis. The end has come for humanity. Not in the red of atomic fusion. Not in the glory of interstellar combustion. Not in the peace of white, cold silence. But with that creeping, grasping flesh below us. It is a joke, hey, Lewis. A great joke. The joke of the cosmos. The end of mankind.
Why?
Because of a chicken's heart.
No, we won't die. I can't die. I'll find a safe landing somewhere. I'll find a place. The motor, it's cut out. We're in a spin. I can't get out of it.
I told you. Doomed.
No. No.
All mankind. Doomed.
No. We're falling right into it. Into the heart. No.
Okay, next we listen to Dimension X's adaptation of one of the most famous stories by one of the most famous science fiction writers of all time. This is Isaac Asimov's Nightfall. It first aired on September the 9th of 1951.
The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, bring you X. Ralph Waldo Emerson speculated, if the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would man believe and adore and perceive for many generations the remembrance of the city of God? Now, this was philosophically interesting. But on the edge of the galaxy, there is a planet which swings on its orbit in a cluster of six suns. These suns hang in the sky above. Never less than two shine down through the entire 23.8 hours of the planet's day. The yellow light has burned down on the planet continuously into the past, till the mind of man runneth not to the contrary. Theremin was a reporter for the Saro City Chronicle. He covered them all, from the night police beat, the politics, to the sports page. And the city editor wanted him to cover the biggest story of the year, perhaps of all time. It was an interview, a particularly difficult interview. But then, since his first days as a cub, Theremin had specialized in difficult interviews. He didn't expect violence, though, from an astronomer.
You're from that newspaper. You've got a lot of gall coming here.
Now, wait a minute, Dr. Anton. It's only a job.
I've read your paper. You've been riding this observatory for 2 months now. You've attacked me personally. I have nothing to say to you.
All right, look, this is your chance to get your side in the paper. I'll give it to you straight. 2 months ago, the observatory issued a press statement that the world was coming to an end. Now, that's the same story that the cult of Revelations has been preaching. And when a scientist backs that up, it's news.
Our conclusions have nothing to do with the cult. The cult of Revelations is full of superstition and mysticism. We are scientists.
Yeah. And you got the people pretty angry.
That does not matter.
You know, if I can't get the story from you, I'll have to go somewhere else.
Go ahead.
All right. You know, Dr. Raton, the paper can be pretty rough on someone who doesn't cooperate.
Young man, if you're not out of the observatory within 5 minutes, I shall call the police. Now get out.
The reporter walks down the long hall from the observatory. The light filters through the high windows, the yellow light of Gamma, the brightest of the six suns in the planet's sky. Beta is almost at zenith. Its red light floods the landscape to an unusual orange. The planet's sun, Alpha, is at the antipodes. And now as Gamma sinks below the horizon, the red dwarf sun, Beta, is alone, grimly alone. It's a short drive from the observatory to Saro City, and the red light glares from the highway. The temple of the cult stands, hewn from the solid rock of the Dolomite Mountains, outside the city. And in the inner courtyard stands Sor, the priest of the cult.
Woe to the unbelievers! Their souls will rot for the absence of light.
Sor! Sor, wait! Your Reverend, please! Please, tell me, Your Reverend, what will happen? What are you waiting for here?
The day! The day of the coming! Written in our doctrine of Revelation, it came to pass that the sun, Beta, was alone in the sky. The world was shrunken and cold. Men did assemble in the public squares and highways. Their minds were troubled and their speech confused, for the souls of men awaited the coming of the stars. The lip of the cave of darkness passed the edge of Beta. Loud were the cries of men. There was no light on the surface of the world. In this blackness there appeared the stars in countless numbers. In that moment the souls of men departed from them. Their abandoned bodies became even as beasts. But the stars then reached down the heaven's flame. Where it touched, the cities of the world flamed to destruction. So that of man and all the works of man naught remained. God.
Sharon, you're the only scientist I could find in the city. Where
Where is everybody?
In the hideout.
In the hideout?
The place bored me. I wanted to be out here where things are getting hot. I want to see the stars the cultists are talking about. Besides, they don't want me at the hideout. I'm too scrawny to survive.
Well, wait a minute. What is the hideout?
Well, we professors have managed to convince a few people that our prophecy of doom is valid. We've got about 3,000 people. They're supposed to hide where the darkness and the stars can't get at them. We hope they'll survive and leave records.
Survive? Survive what?
Oh, there are lots of names for it. The cultists have their myths.
Oh, yes. What about that? What is there to these myths? As a matter of fact, what is there to this doctrine of revelation?
I'm a psychologist, not an archaeologist. How true it is, I don't know. But the cultists say that every 2,050 years, all the suns disappear, and there is a total darkness. And then they say things appear called stars. Of course, men go mad. They mix all this up with a lot of religio-mystic notions, but that is the central idea.
Yeah. Well, that's impossible, isn't it? I mean, there are always at least two suns in the sky, most of the time four or five.
There are not now, only Beta.
Dr. Sharon, you mean that there's going to be worldwide darkness tomorrow? That all mankind will go violently insane? What's behind that?
Well, for one thing, this is history of civilization of the world. We've located a series of cycles of civilizations comparable to our own, all of which, without exception, were destroyed by fire at the very height of their culture.
All right. But is there any scientific theory behind this then that would explain it?
The university observatory finished their calculations 2 months ago. Tomorrow there will be an eclipse of Beta so that the planet will become dark. That eclipse comes every 2,049 years. Darkness comes. Maybe those mysterious stars that no man has ever seen. And then, madness and the end of civilization.
I see. And the scientists expect to live through this at the hideout.
They plan to photograph the eclipse and leave the records. And then the rest of mankind will know what to expect.
Dr. Sharon, what is there in darkness to drive men mad?
Have you ever experienced darkness, young man?
No, but I know what it is. It's just, well, no light.
Draw the curtain.
Well, what for? If we had four or five suns out there, we might want to cut the light down for comfort, but with only Beta...
That is the point. Just draw the curtain and then come here and sit down.
All right. Dr. Sharon, I can't see you.
Feel your way.
Yeah, but I can't see. I can't see anything.
Do you like it?
Well, no, it's awful. The walls. They seem to be closing in on me. I want to... keep pushing him away.
All right. Throw the curtain back again.
The light. The light. Dr. Sharon, have you got a drink?
Right here. That was just a dark room.
Yeah. It wasn't really so bad.
You're afraid.
Yes, I am. Just darkness can do that?
This isn't just a metaphysical theory, young man. It's promulgated from observed data. Come with me.
Where?
The locked ward down the corridor.
All right.
Were you at the Sarrow City Centennial Exposition 2 years ago?
No, I was overseas on assignment.
Remember hearing about the tunnel of mystery that broke all records in the amusement area?
Yeah. Wasn't there some fuss about it? The Anti-Vice Society had it shut down?
It was shut down, all right, but the Pluto's had nothing to do with it.
Oh?
That tunnel was nothing but a mile-long passage through darkness. You rode in a little car, and it took 15 minutes to get through. Very popular while it lasted.
Popular?
There's a fascination in being frightened when it's part of a game. Absence of light is one of the instinctive human fears. People came out of that 15 minutes of darkness shaking and half dead with fear.
Half dead? I thought there was some death.
Bad heart. But that wasn't the big danger. Now, which key is it?
Wait a minute, Dr. Sherrod. Where are we going?
You'll see. No, the heart attacks were actually good for business. But there was something else. Here, I'll show you. I want you to see somebody. Latimer?
Go away.
Latimer, I want you to meet somebody. This is Mr. Theremin.
No, go away.
Hello?
He's pushing me. Make him stop pushing me. Go away.
I'm not touching him. What's wrong?
Latimer is afraid.
The walls. They're falling in on me. The walls. I've got to get out. Let me out.
You can't go out, Latimer. It's all right.
I've got to get out. Let me out. Let me out.
That sleeping period, we have to give him a shot of morphine. Otherwise, he fat his brains out against the wall.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing. Nothing but 15 minutes in the darkness of the tunnel of mystery.
Oh, Doctor, that's impossible.
One person out of 10 came out of the tunnel that way. That's why we had to shut it down.
Why? Why should doctors do that?
It's obvious man cannot exist without light. Longer periods of darkness would obviously be fatal. The scientific theory is that the consciousness of light is necessary for mental activity.
Please, doctor, let me out. Please, I can't breathe. They're pushing me. They're always pushing me. I can't stand them.
There you are, Theremin. That's what 15 minutes of darkness will do. Man just wasn't built to operate without light. There are always at least two suns in the sky, most of the time more.
Minutes of darkness.
Now then, look out of that window. Imagine darkness everywhere. No light as far as you can see. Black. Everything black. And the stars, whatever they are. Well, can you conceive it? Your mind wasn't built for that conception. When the real thing comes, you go mad completely and permanently. There's no question of it. Tomorrow there won't be a city left standing in the world.
Well, why, Doctor? Why should the cities be destroyed?
If you were in darkness, what would you want more than anything else? What would it be that every instinct would call for? Light. And how would you get light?
I don't know.
You'd burn something, and every city in the world will go up in flames. Shall we go back to my office, Mr. Theremin, and have another drink?
Through the sky, the red sun Beta shines alone. The wind howls across the city. It's cold, colder than man can remember. As the hour approaches, the reporter goes out and speaks to the man in the street.
Excuse me, sir, but I'm from the Chronicle. I'd like to talk to you.
Ah, a reporter, huh?
That's right.
My name is Pellet. Two L's. Remember the two L's.
All right. Now, Mr. Pellet, what's your occupation?
Power technician at the North Division plant. You're making some kind of a survey, huh?
Yeah, in a way. Where are you going now?
Home for supper.
Well, how about, what I mean is, what are you going to do tonight?
You mean about this star stuff?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, mister. It don't stand to reason that the end of the world is going to come boom like that. It just don't stand to reason.
In other words, you don't believe it.
I didn't say that, but it just don't stand to reason.
Have you read what the scientists say?
I don't read stuff like that. Only the headlines.
Yeah. How about the cult?
Well, now, like I always say, I've got nothing against religion.
You don't believe them either?
Well, they've always been shouting about doom and sin. Listen, bud, when you've been around as long as I have, you get to know the score. It's all right to preach that Judgment Day is coming and all, but just the same, I'm putting money in the bank.
Well, tell me, how about darkness?
About what?
How would you feel if there was no light?
You crazy?
How could there be no light?
Well, now, suppose all the suns went down at once. Suppose everything was black.
Well, it's crazy. What's the use of supposing something like that? It couldn't happen. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's all. Thank you.
Sure. Look, mister, remember Pollitt with two L's?
Oh, excuse me, sir, but I represent the Chronicle, and we're conducting a poll to determine public opinion with regard to the predicted end of the world. How do you feel about it?
All this talk of scientific explanation. It's sinful. That's what it is.
Oh, I see. Well, then you're a member of the cult, sir.
I sure am. Been a member since I was a boy. My daddy was a member, too. I've seen the books. It's all written down in the books.
Well, don't you believe the scientist's explanation?
Don't need it. Going to save my immortal soul. Going to stay on the mountaintop in a white robe while the stars carry me away to glory. Blessed be the stars. Amen.
Well, tell me, what are the stars?
The glory. The breath of the heavens. The spirit of the ultimate. That's what they are.
Well, sir, the observatory has announced that it intends to take pictures of these stars.
Blasphemy. I sold my house. Gave all my money to the poor. Won't need it anymore. Going to heaven with stars. Glory, glory, going with the stars.
Business at a standstill. Doesn't pay to buy anything today, not if the world's going to end tomorrow. There are predictions of economic collapse in the financial section. Layoffs at the factories on the edge of the city. Through the streets, the people mill and turn, unsure, crying in fear or shouting with bravado. But the story isn't here, in the city. And so as the hour approaches, the reporter goes again to the observatory, high in the hills.
Now, look, Dr. Redstone, if you are right, if the world is going to be destroyed, what's the difference if I stay here and observe and take notes?
Oh, nothing, I suppose, but you'll be in the way. We have work to do.
All right, if I stay out of the way.
I can't be bothered with you. You'll have to leave, Mr. Salmon.
Hello. Hello.
Oh, hello, Dr. Sharon.
Yeah, this place is like a morgue. It's freezing outside. The wind is enough to hang icicles on your nose. Beta doesn't seem to give any heat at all. It's so far away.
Why aren't you in the hideout, Sharon?
Me? I'm part of the race that isn't worth perpetuating. Who's got a bottle?
There will be no alcohol today. It would be too easy to get my men drunk. I can't afford to tempt them. Well, all right, Sam, and you can stay, but keep out of the way.
Well, thank you, Doctor.
Well, gentlemen, I think it's time we took our positions. The observatory dome is up these stairs.
Yes, sir. After you, Doctor.
What's that?
Dome, quick! Oh, what is it?
Data you had. In return, I promised to prove the essential truth of the creed.
There's no need to prove that. Stands proved by the doctrine of revelation.
I offered scientific backing for you believers.
You made of the darkness and the stars the natural phenomenon, removed all its real significance. That was blasphemy.
These facts exist.
Your facts are a fraud and a delusion.
How do you know?
I know.
I suppose you think in trying to warn the world against the menace of madness, we are facing souls in jeopardy. Well, we have not succeeded, if that makes you feel better.
Your devilish instruments must be destroyed. We obey the will of the stars.
Someone call the police in Cerro City.
There's no time for that. Let me handle this. The eclipse is only a few minutes away. Look, Thor, will you give your word of honor to cause no trouble?
I will not.
Listen. Just as soon as the eclipse starts, we're going to take you and put you in a closet with
the door closed, and you stay there. Then you won't see the darkness, and you won't see the stars. And that means the loss of your immortal soul, according to the cult. All right now, will you give your word of honor?
You have it. You will all be damned for your deeds of today.
Look! Look at Vader!
The eclipse has started. Yes, you can see the blackness against Vader. Get into your camera.
Yes, sir.
Let me hold it carefully.
We will. You're shaking, Mr. Tanner.
Oh, I don't feel very well, Mr. Tanner.
You're not losing your nerve?
No, I'm just not used to it.
You could probably make the hideout.
Now, look, I've been assigned to cover a story and intend to cover it.
Professional honor?
Yeah. I'll give my right arm for a bottle right now. I need a drink. What's that?
The cultist. That's the doctrine of revelation.
I don't understand it.
He's chanting some old psycho language. The doctrine...
Dr. Sharon, how do the cultists manage to keep the doctrine of revelation going from cycle to cycle? If everyone goes mad, who wrote this doctrine?
There are some people who don't see the stars. The blind. They would have memories, and that, combined with the confused, incoherent babbling of the mad, form the basis for the doctrine of revelation. The cult will be riding high down there in the city. I hope they make the most of it.
Dr. Sharon, I just heard from hideout on private line.
They're in trouble?
They are safe. But the city is in shambles. You have no idea.
Is it worse? What are you shaking about, Doctor? How do you feel?
I don't understand. The cultists are rousing the people to storm the observatory. Promising them salvation. Promising them anything.
How long till the total eclipse?
An hour. I'm going to check those cameras.
It's a gamble. It'll take time to get a mob out here. If the darkness comes first, we're all right. Look at Vader.
Yeah. It's cut in half.
Getting darker. An interesting phenomenon.
The collar's suddenly tight.
Are you having any difficulty in breathing?
No. Why?
Difficulty in breathing is one of the first symptoms we've experimented.
I'm cold. Seems to be getting colder.
We'd better keep our minds on something else.
Yeah.
One of the astronomers has a theory about stars. He thinks they may be suns that are too far away to see in the light. He developed a fantasy about a planet revolving around one sun. It's a mathematical possibility. Of course, there couldn't be any light. Part of the planet would always be dark and without light. Well, it's obvious. Without light, there can't be any life.
Time for the artificial light. We can't read the instruments.
Artificial light?
One of the researchers in the university worked it out. It's animal grease packed around a wick. Here, I'll light it with this spark.
Why, it's beautiful. Yellow light. After 4 hours of red. It's beautiful. Light.
The dome is quiet. The priest in his yellow robe sways slowly as his lips move in the ancient tongue. Over and over he whispers the invocation to the stars. The technicians hunch over the instrument, and the sky gradually turns a horrible deep purple red. The air grows denser. Dust, like a palpable entity, enters the room. The dancing circle of yellow light about the torches edges itself into ever sharper distinction against the ever-gathering grayness beyond. Outside, Vader is a mere smoldering splendor, taking a last look at the world. The western horizon in the direction of the city is lost in darkness. And along the highway to the observatory surges a menacing, shadowy mass.
The mob from the city. They're coming.
How long till total eclipse?
15 minutes. But that mob will be here in 5.
We'll hold them off. Come on, Simon, downstairs.
Now, wait a minute. There's no light down there.
We have to block the door. Come on.
I can't breathe. I can't go down there.
Take a torch. We take light with us. Come on.
Thank you.
bar the door.
They won't get in.
All right now, everybody. 1 minute to totality. 1 minute. Just before totality, I'm changing the plate. That will leave one of you for each camera. Now remember, if you feel yourself going, get away from the camera.
It's dark. It's getting dark,
sir.
Sir, why? I can't see it.
I'm out here.
30 seconds.
Look out, the priest. I can't see it.
And the wicked shall perish. And the souls of the true believers shall be transported in glory to the stars.
You can see him against the door.
Don't let him get to the telescope. From the stars there reached down a heavenly flame. And where it touched, the cities of the world flamed to utter destruction.
Grab him! Grab him!
I'll take care of him. The world must be destroyed by the
stars. I got it!
5 seconds to totality. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Sky is black, and through it shine the stars. 30,000 minute suns shine down in soul-searing splendor. It's more frightening in its awful indifference than the bitter wind that shivers across the horrible, cold, bleak world.
The stars. The stars! The stars! The walls! They're coming in, Orvin! They're coming in! Light! Light!
Darkness!
Light!
Never, never, the walls are breaking in! We did not know! We did not know! We did not know!
Horizon in the direction of the city, a crimson glow begins growing. A thousand fires strengthen in brightness that is not the glow of the sun. A million fires, as a world mad in the darkness screams in terror for the light. The night has come again. Presented, transcribed each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Greek Smith, publishers of the magazine Astounding Science Fiction. Today, Dimension X has presented Nightfall, written for radio by Ernest Chinoy, from the story by Isaac Asimov. Featured in the cast were Lyle Soudreau as the reporter, Cameron Prudhomme as the astronomer, and John McGovern as the psychologist. Your host, Norman Rose. Music by Bert Berman. Dimension X is produced by William Welch and directed by Fred Way.
Nightfall was actually written at the suggestion of John W. Campbell, who at the time was the editor of Astounding Science Fiction and well-known as an editor who developed new talent, who gave Asimov the Emerson quote that begins the short story. This is one of Asimov's early stories, being published in 1941 in Astounding Science Fiction. In 1968, the Science Fiction Writers of America voted Nightfall the best science fiction story ever written prior to the establishment of the Nebula Award, and was included in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame Volume 1, which covered the years 1929 to 1964. Next is the Hall of Fantasy. The Hall of Fantasy had a rather checkered history during its run. It began in 1946 as a local program for KALL in Salt Lake City and appeared sporadically in 1947, 1949, and 1952. In 1952, it found syndication nationwide over mutual stations. The stories were written by Richard Thorne and were often adaptations of classic works of horror. This particular episode is from June the 29th of 1953.
And now, the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friend. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of the Temple of Huitzilopochtli.
I didn't think that day when I came back to our apartment in Caracas after a talk with the old man that Fred Taylor and I were going to wish we'd never heard of oil.
That you, Mike?
Yes, Fred. And what are you doing?
Taking a shower. Come on in. Well, did you see him?
I saw him, all right.
What'd you say?
I said I saw him.
Well, what did he say about the vacation?
He said no.
Well, how come? We have one coming.
Yeah, but not till we finish this next job.
Just a second.
Now, tell me what he said. Ever hear of the Juruena River?
Yes, it's in Brazil. Empties into the Amazon.
Well, that's where we're going.
What?
That's right.
Well, you're kidding.
No, I'm not. The company just leased a big tract of land along the river. We're to go in and see if we can find any traces of oil or uranium.
Uranium?
Yes. Bartell's group flew over the tract. The way they've got it figured out, there's not only oil there, but also uranium.
So Bartell flew over it. Why don't they send Bartell to walk over it, or paddling down the river like we'll have to do?
Well, Bartell is senior on the staff. He gets the cream, we get the hominy grits.
So who'll in it?
Mm-hmm.
Say, if I remember right, there's some parts of that river that have never been explored. It's in the northern Mato Grosso region, isn't it?
Yes.
There might be a few natives in that unexplored part that wouldn't want us to be sticking our big noses into their business.
Well, the old man said he'd throw in an extra week in the States with pay.
Hey, I can hear you talking. When do we start?
As soon as we can pack and hop a plane to Cuiaba.
He doesn't want any grass to grow under our feet, does he?
I guess not. And don't forget to pack your guns. We might need them. We cleared ourselves with the Brazilian Consul General in Caracas, picked up our visas, and at midnight boarded the plane that would take us to Cuiaba.
Mike, you wait.
There I am now. Where are we?
Just crossed over into Brazil.
Why'd you wake me?
I don't know.
Oh, that's nice.
No, I don't know what it is. I can't sleep. I can't sleep. We should never have started out on this trip.
Why shouldn't we?
Funny thing. I just have a feeling.
Yes, senor. Please, you cry.
Oh, I got you, amigo.
You go to sleep and keep the other passengers awake. Well, just the same. I wish we hadn't started out on this safari. It's got me worried.
Landed in Cuiaba, got checked out by the Brazilian authorities, and then went about the business of finding ourselves a guide. Most of them were familiar with the territory leading to the source of the Juruena on the plateau of the Mato Grosso. But none of them had been any farther than 200 miles down the river, and none of them were willing to act as our guide. After we spoke to them, I received the impression that they were afraid. Fred was having a drink when he came up and spoke to us.
We're doing fine. We can't even find the guide.
Well, we can always follow the map Bartell drew up for us.
We're not in the mood to go into the lowlands alone, Mike. There are too many ways a man can die down there.
Well, what else can we do?
Pardon me, senores.
You want something, amigo?
I understand you are looking for a guide.
That's right.
I may be able to help you. My name is Juan Torrigo.
Well, have a seat.
Gracias, senor.
You care for a drink?
No, senor.
You know where we can get a guide?
Si.
Where?
I can guide you.
You know the Juruena River?
Si, senor. Most of it. And that I do not know. I'm willing to make the acquaintance of.
What do you know? We look all over Cuyaba for a guide, and then one falls right into our laps.
Right. When can you start?
When do you want to leave, senor?
As soon as possible.
The other guide said that no one was familiar with the river.
I am, senor. I will be ready when you want to leave.
Can you get the supplies and the boat we need?
You will not get a boat in Cuyaba, senor. Supplies and a canoe, that is possible. A boat, I cannot get that for you. Nor can anyone else.
We'll settle for that, then. Oh, you'll need some money. Here.
No, senor. I can pay for the canoe and supplies. You can repay me later.
Well, that sounds all right to me.
Perhaps you can rent an automobile and hire someone to come with us as far as the river. Then he can drive it back to Cuyaba.
That's a good idea. Now it's for
payment. I am not worried about payment, senor. I am sure I can trust you enough to pay me well for my work. I will be ready to leave tomorrow morning.
Good. Get the canoe and the supplies.
Si. I will meet you at your hotel tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. From there, we can pick up our supplies. We leave early?
Yes, about 6.
Well, tomorrow morning, we begin a great adventure. Buenas noches, senor.
Buenas noches. Seems to be a pretty competent guy, doesn't he?
Yes.
Well, we'll know tomorrow morning.
Right.
Senores?
Yes, senorita.
I could not help but see you talking to Juan Torrigo, senores. I know you are looking for a guide. Has he offered to guide you?
Yes, he has. Why?
I would not do it, senores. He's El Diablo, that one.
What do you mean?
Many parties he has led out, senores, to the Huarena River. Always. He has returned alone. Never has he brought back with him any of those he has led out. Something happens to them, senores, and they are never heard from again.
Back now to our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Temple of Huitzilopochtli.
Notwithstanding the warning of the girl, we started out the following day for the source of the Huarena. The roads for the first part of the trip were fair, but as we drew farther away from Cuyaba, they became worse. We bumped and jolted our way along for the next 5 hours until we came to the source of the Huarena. We unloaded the canoe and supplies and had to portage downstream for almost a mile before the stream became wide enough to use a canoe.
Where does this tract of land your company lease begin, senor?
About 150 miles down the river, about 10 degrees south of the equator.
That is an unexplored area, senor Prescott.
We had a party take a look at it from a plane first before the lease went through.
But no one has ever been through the land underground. No one has ever really seen that area.
That's right, Juan.
How far do you think we can go before dark, Juan?
50, 60 miles, Senor Taylor. As long as we paddle with the current.
How far have you been down?
Oh, don't worry, Senor. I have been down this river quite far.
The current was swift, and we made excellent time that first afternoon. Towards evening, Juan spotted a good campsite, and we paddled into shore and set up camp. We had a good meal. And we were sitting around the fire when we heard the first drum.
With good luck, we ought to make the edge of the track your company leaves by tomorrow night, senor.
That's when the work will really begin.
You know, I'm...
Listen. Drums.
Do not be afraid, senor.
Where are they coming from?
Somewhere down the river, I think.
Listen. There's another one.
Have you ever heard them before, Juan?
Si, senor. Many times before. But there is nothing to worry about. The way you look, one would think they were beating for you.
Drums pounded throughout the night. I didn't sleep very well with that incessant throbbing beating against my ears. Towards morning, they were quiet, and I fell off to sleep. By 6 o'clock, we were up, had eaten, and were on the river.
Rapids coming up, senores.
Yeah, they sound pretty bad.
They are bad ones. We must be very careful.
With Bartels down here.
Look out, senores. There we go.
Now, this is the first street we've got to hit.
Ah! Oh, senor.
Hey, we're heading for a rock.
Hold on, senores. Ah, that is the worst of them, senores.
I didn't think we'd ever get through those things alive.
I was a little worried myself.
No, it's not the time to worry, senores. The rapids are nothing compared to what may lie ahead.
What do you mean by that, Juan?
Oh,
Not a thing, signore. But who can tell what may happen?
According to our map, we had reached the beginning of the company's tract of land. We made camp at a spot about 10 degrees south of the equator.
Good meal, Juan.
Gracias, Senor Taylor.
Yeah. According to the stories we heard, this is as far as anyone has ever penetrated down the Huruena. No one has ever gone beyond this.
You are wrong in that, Senor Prescott. No one has ever gone beyond this point and lived. Many have gone beyond, and all of them have crossed into the land of their ancestors.
Sounds like a threat, Juan.
Why should I threaten you, Senor Taylor?
I don't know.
The drums again.
They have such a plaintive sound to them, do they not, Senores?
Plaintive nothing. They give me the creeps. I wonder why they never explored this section of Brazil.
Many have tried. All have failed.
You seem to know a lot about this area, Juan.
Oh, a good deal, Senor Prescott. In this unexplored area is a race of people not lost to the world.
What do you mean? What people?
When Cortes conquered Mexico, he did not conquer all the Aztecs. Part of the nation followed Cuitlahua down through Central America into South America, into Brazil, senores. Into an unexplored part of Brazil, on the very edge of which our camp lies tonight.
Are you serious, Juan?
Why should I lie, Senor Prescott? We stand close to death. The three of us.
Listen.
Yes, I heard that cry before.
What is it?
The call of Huitzilopochtli, the ancient war deity of the Aztecs. Huitzilopochtli calling into the night, ordering that the sacrifices be brought to him.
That drum is pretty close to it.
Quite close, Senor Prescott. And do you know what it is saying?
No, what?
It is saying that we come for the men of another age. We come to bring them back to the temple of Huitzilopochtli.
You mean there, out there in the dark?
See?
I'm getting out of here.
I'm afraid not.
Where did you get... That's my gun. How did you get it?
While you were sleeping last night, amigo. We are here, Huitzilopochtli! We are here!
What are you going to do with us?
You will run that soon, amigo.
Mike, look.
They must have been hidden behind the trees out there.
Os pastores! Tirana!
Os pastores! Tirana! Digo ahead!
Imolajas!
Imolajas!
They have been waiting for us. We will go with them to the temple of Huitzilopochtli.
They didn't want to take any chance of our getting away, did they? They tied my hands so tightly, I think they stopped the circulation.
Well, that's the way mine feel, too.
Yeah. I read about these when I was still a kid. Do you know where we are?
No.
Cortez found them when he first went into Mexico. This is the Teocalli, Temple of the Aztecs.
What's in those two towers at either side of this landing?
The sacred images of the presiding deities.
And those blocks of stone in front of the towers?
Those are the sacrificial altars.
Mike, we have to get out of here.
Look, coming up the stairs to the top here is Juan Perico.
But he's not wearing the clothes he wore before. He's wearing a scarlet robe.
Yeah, so I see. A robe of the sacrificial priest.
Amigo, are you enjoying our hospitality?
What do you intend doing with us, Perico?
Don't you know?
No.
Have you looked over the side, amigo?
Yes.
And did you notice the people gathering?
Yes.
They have come to witness a ceremony. The altar of Huitzilopochtli has been dry too long.
What do you mean?
That it has been some time since the high priest has made an offering to Huitzilopochtli.
And we're to be the offering. Is that right?
That's right, amigos. You are to be the offering.
And you dirty...
No! You should not lose your temper, amigo. If you are nice, I will make sure your death is speedy. If you continue to act as you have in the past, I hesitate to say how long it will take for death to finally put its mantle on you.
We should have taken the advice of the girl in Cuiaba.
Oh, yes. The girl in Cuiaba. Porfadores, Silana!
Porfadores, Silana! Sim, Molotek, Molotek!
Let me go! Let me go!
Let her go! Amigos, this is Maria Espanta, the girl who warned you about me. I had some of my men bring her here.
She will be the third offering. And now I leave you. Until later. Adios, amigos. Lana! Marguerite!
What happened, Maria?
They came and took me that night. The night I spoke to you. Diego must have been watching. And they brought me here. What will they do with us?
Kill us in the sacrificial ceremony.
Oh, no.
Maria, your hands are free. Untie us.
What?
Untie us. Maybe it'll give us a little more of a chance when the time comes.
See, I will untie you.
I wonder what they did with our gun.
I don't know.
They tie you very well, senor.
Yes, I know.
Now, you, senor.
We have to get some circulation back into the...
You've
cut
your wrist, senor.
Yes, I know.
There's
something brewing. Hurry up.
Oh, yeah,
it is. Man, that feels better. Thanks, Maria.
What can we do, senor?
I don't know, but we're sitting ducks here. Let's try one of those towers. Come on.
Right.
You've got a glance over the side. There must be 1,000 people down there surrounding the temple.
And they're all waiting to see us die. Inside, hurry.
Look, senor.
Human skulls lining the walls of this place.
It's horrible.
The ancient Aztecs kept the skulls of their sacrifices.
How many have died here?
I wouldn't like to know. We're going to die here if we don't do something.
Hey, look. Isn't that an entrance over there?
Yes. Let's take a look.
It is a stairway that is down inside the temple.
They're coming for us. The only thing we can do is take that stairway. Here. You take one of these torches. Right, I'll take the other. Maria, you stay right behind us.
Yes, no.
Let's go.
I only hope from that happening out of the frying pan into the fire.
If we wait a certain death, at least we might have a chance this way.
Oh, it is so dark in here.
There's a landing just ahead. Careful now.
Right.
Put your torch a little higher, Fred.
Hey, look. It's a room. If I'm not mistaken, right in the center, those are guns.
Guns. Let's take a look.
Not our guns.
Perhaps they are guns taken from the other men who came here.
That must be it. Guns and ammunition. We have something now to fight with.
Over on the other side of the room, the stairway continues. Will we take it, senor?
Yes, we will. First, we take the guns. All the guns and ammunition we can carry.
Hurry. They'll probably figure that we came down here.
Well, they slipped up and they left Maria's hands untied.
I carry guns and ammunition, too. I cannot shoot, but I can load them for you.
Good girl.
How you fix mine?
I have as many as I can carry. My pockets are full of bullets.
Maria?
I have 5 guns, and I carry this knapsack full of ammunition.
Then what's holding us back?
You said it. Let's get going.
Right.
For almost an hour.
When we came to the bottom of the stairs, I thought we'd come to an opening somewhere right away. Now, I'm not so sure. I don't know where this tunnel is leading us.
I think we're pretty close to an exit. I can feel the air moving.
Do you think they are in back of us?
I don't know.
Well, Torrigo will not be beaten this easily.
I know that.
Hey, look up ahead.
Huh?
Isn't that moonlight up there?
See, we are nearing the end of the passageway.
I wonder where we'll be when we come out.
I hear the drums again.
It's a different beat this time.
Perhaps they did look for us.
Maybe. Say, we're coming to the opening. Be careful when we step outside.
You think maybe...
I don't know.
Well, we're here.
Yes. And listen. We're close to the river.
It looked like our camp was here. They must have come through the tunnel when they surrounded us.
That must be it.
I wonder if the canoe was still there.
Let's take a look, shall we?
Oh, I have a feeling that... They are here! They have been waiting for us!
Ah! Nothing like
them,
Nicole!
We have been waiting for
us!
Where are you,
Tony?
Ah!
You
did not think we
would
get away! Did you?
The canoe is there. I see it. Look from the correct direction. Maria, take a gun in each hand and shoot when I give the command into the trees, anywhere. We'll all run for the canoe. If we keep our firepower up, we may be able to make it.
Ha 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 ha! What you talking about, Tony? You go back! Come on, baby! Ha 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 ha!
Get ready now.
All right, together.
Hurry.
All right, Maria, get in. They're coming, boys. Come on.
Hey, they're all together. Let's give them a volley. They won't forget.
Do you think they follow us, Signore?
No, Maria, I don't.
Not after what happened.
You know something?
What?
Tarigo seemed to be their leader.
Yes, and as soon as he fell, they clustered around him.
Well, I
don't think they'll be following us.
Signore?
Huh?
Where do we go now?
We'll go down the river till we come to a town. It'll be too hard getting back up.
What about the company, Mike?
I don't know about the company. But I'm not coming back here. We're too close for me. If they want to explore this country, they can send in someone else. I've come close enough to death. At the temple of Huitzilopochtli.
So runs tonight's tale of the unusual, the terrifying, the unknown. Join us again when next we journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to hear another strange tale of the supernatural. All characters and events portrayed in these programs are fictional, and any similarity to actual events or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
The last segment, I'm in debt to the LibriVox Project and Mr. Glenn Hallstrom, a.k.a. Smokestack Jones, who will be reading H.P. Lovecraft's The Street. The Street was published in December 1920 in a magazine called The Wolverine.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recorded by me, Glenn Hallstrom, also known as Smokestack Jones. SmokestackJones@gmail.com. You'll also find my blog at TooMuchJohnson.blogspot.com. The Street by H.P. Lovecraft. There will be those who say that things and places have souls, and there be those who say they have not. I dare not say myself, but I will tell of the street. Men of strength and honor fashioned that street, good valiant men of our blood who had come from the Blessed Isles across the sea. At first it was but a path trodden by bearers of water from the woodland spring to the cluster of houses by the beach. Then, as more men came to the growing cluster of houses and looked about for places to dwell, they built cabins along the north side, cabins of stout oaken logs with masonry on the side of the forest, for many Indians lurked there with fire arrows, and in a few years more men built cabins on the south side of the street. Up and down the street walked brave men in conical hats, who most of the time carried muskets or fowling pieces, and there were also their bonneted wives and sober children. In the evening these men with their wives and children would sit about gigantic hearths and read and speak. Very simple were the things of which they read and spoke, yet things which gave them courage and goodness and helped them by day to subdue the forest and till the fields. And the children would listen and learn of the laws and deeds of old and of that dear England which they had never seen or could not remember. There was war, and thereafter no more Indians troubled the street. The men, busy with labor, waxed prosperous and as happy as they knew how to be, and the children grew up comfortable, and more families came from the motherland to dwell on the street. And the children's children and the newcomers' children grew up. The town was now a city, and one by one the cabins gave place to houses, simple, beautiful houses of brick and wood, with stone steps and iron railings and fanlights over the doors. No flimsy creations were these houses, for they were made to serve many a generation. Within these were carven mantels and graceful stairs and sensible, pleasing furniture, china and silver brought from the motherland. So the street drank in the dreams of a young people and rejoiced as its dwellers became more graceful and happy. Where once had been only strength and honor, taste and learning now abode as well. Books and paintings and music came to the houses, and the young men went to the university which rose above the plain to the north. In the place of conical hats and small swords, of lace and snowy periwigs,
There were cobblestones over which clattered many a blooded horse and rumbled many a gilded coach, and brick sidewalks with horse blocks and hitching posts. There were in that street many trees, elms and oaks and maples of dignity, so that in the summer the scene was all soft for dew and twittering bird song. And behind the houses were walled rose gardens with hedged paths and sundials, where at evening the moon and stars would shine bewitchingly, while fragrant blossoms glistened with dew. So the street dreamed on, past wars, calamities, and change. Once most of the young men went away, and some never came back. That was when they furled the old flag and put up a new banner of stripes and stars. But though the men talked of great changes, the street felt them not, for its folk were still the same, speaking of the old familiar things in the old familiar accounts. And the trees still sheltered singing birds, and at evening the moon and stars looked down upon dewy blossoms in the walled rose gardens. In time there were no more swords, three-cornered hats, or periwigs in the street. How strange seemed the inhabitants with their walking sticks, tall beavers, and cropped heads. New sounds came from the distance. First strange puffings and shrieks from the river a mile away, and then, many years later, strange puffings and shrieks and rumblings from other directions. The air was not quite so pure as before, but the spirit of the place had not changed. The blood and soul of their ancestors had fashioned the street. Nor did the spirit change when they tore open the earth to lay down strange pipes, or when they set up tall posts bearing weird lines. There was so much ancient lore in that street that the past could not easily be forgotten. Then came days of evil, when many who had known the street of old knew it no more, and many knew it who had not known it before and went away, for their accents were coarse and strident, and their mien and faces unpleasing. Their thoughts, too, fought with the wise, just spirit of the street, so that the street pined silently as its houses fell into decay, and its trees dried one by one, and its rose gardens grew rank with weeds and waste. But it felt a stir of pride one day when, again, marched forth young men, some of whom never came back. These young men were clad in blue. With the years, worse fortune came to the street. Its trees were all gone now, and its rose gardens were displaced by the backs of cheap, ugly new buildings on parallel streets. Yet the houses remained, despite the ravages of the years and the storms and worms, for they had been made to serve many a generation. New kinds of faces appeared in the street, swarthy, sinister faces with furtive eyes and odd features, whose owners spoke unfamiliar words and placed signs in known and unknown characters upon most of the musty houses. Pushcarts crowded the gutters. A sordid, undefinable stench settled over the place, and the ancient spirit slept. Great excitement once came to the street. War and revolution were raging across the seas. A dynasty had collapsed, and its degenerate subjects were flocking with dubious intent into the western land. Many of these took lodgings in the battered houses that had once known the songs of birds and the scent of roses. Then the western land itself awoke and joined the motherland in her titanic struggle for civilization. Over the cities once more floated the old flag, companioned by a new flag and by a plainer yet glorious tricolor. But not many flags floated over the street, for therein brooded only fear and hatred and ignorance. Again young men went forth, but not quite as did the young men in those other days. Something was lacking. And the sons of those young men in other days, who did indeed go forth in olive drab with the true spirit of their ancestors, went from distant places and knew not the street in its ancient spirit. Over the seas there was a great victory, and in triumph most of the young men returned. Those who had lacked something lacked it no longer, yet fear and hatred and ignorance still brooded over the street, for many had stayed behind, and many strangers had come from distant places to the ancient houses. And the young men who had returned dwelt there no longer. Swarthy and sinister were most of the strangers, yet among them one might find a few faces like those who fashioned the street and molded its spirit. Like and yet unlike, for there was in the eyes of all a weird, unhealthy glitter as of greed, ambition, vindictiveness, or misguided zeal. Unrest and treason were abroad amongst an evil few who plotted to strike the western land its death blow, that they might mount to power over its ruins, even as assassins had mounted in that unhappy frozen land from whence most of them had come. And the heart of that plotting was in the street, whose crumbling houses teemed with alien makers of discord, and echoed with the plans and speeches of those who yearned for an appointed day of blood, flame, and crime. Of the various odd assemblages in the street, the law said much, but could prove little. With great diligence did men of hidden badges linger and listen about such places as Petrovich's Bakery, the squalid Rifkin School of Modern Economics, the Circle Social Club, and the Liberty Cafe. There congregated sinister men in great numbers, yet always was their speech guarded or in a foreign tongue. And still the old houses stood with their forgotten lore of nobler departed centuries of sturdy colonial tenants and dewy rose gardens in the moonlight. Sometimes a lone poet or traveler would come to view them, and would try to picture them in their vanished glory, yet of such travelers and poets there were not many. The rumor now spread widely that these houses contained the leaders of a vast band of terrorists, who on a designated day were to launch an orgy of slaughter for the extermination of America and for all the fine old traditions which the street had loved. Handbills and papers fluttered about filthy gutters, handbills and papers printed in many tongues and in many characters, yet all bearing messages of crime and rebellion. In these writings the people were urged to tear down the laws and virtues that our fathers had exalted, to stamp out the soul of the old America, the soul that was once bequeathed through 1,500 years of Anglo-Saxon freedom, justice, and moderation. It was said that the swarthy men who dwelt in the street and congregated in its rotting edifices were the brains of a hideous revolution, and at their word of command many millions of brainless, besotted beasts would stretch forth with their noisome talons from the slums of 1,000 cities, burning, slaying, and destroying until the land of our fathers should be no more. All this was said and repeated, and many looked forward in dread to the 4th day of July, about which the strange writings hid in much, yet could nothing be found to place the guilt. None could tell just whose arrest might cut off the damnable plotting at its source. Many times came bands of blue-coated police to search the shaky houses, though at last they ceased to come, for they too had grown tired of law and order, and had abandoned all the city to its fate. Then the men in olive drab came, bearing muskets, till it seemed as if in its sad sleep the street must have some haunting dreams of those other days, when musket-bearing men in conical hats walked along it from the woodland spring to the cluster of houses by the beach. Yet no act be performed to check the impending cataclysm, for the swarthy, sinister men were old and cunning. So the street slept uneasily on, till one night there gathered in Petrovich's Bakery and the Rifkin School of Modern Economics and the Circle Social Club and the Liberty Cafe and in other places as well, vast hordes of men whose eyes were big with horrible triumph and expectation. Over hidden wires strange messages traveled, and much was said of still stranger messages yet to travel. But most of this was not guessed till afterward, when the western land was safe from the peril. The men in olive drab could not tell what was happening, nor what they ought to do, for the swarthy sinister men were skilled in subtlety and concealment. And yet the men in olive drab will always remember that night, and will speak of the street as they tell of it to their grandchildren, for many of them were sent there toward morning on a mission unlike that which they had expected. It was known that this nest of anarchy was old, and that the houses were tottering from the ravages of the years and the storms and worms, yet was the happening of that summer night a surprise because of its very queer uniformity? It was indeed an exceedingly singular happening, though after all a simple one. For without warning, in one of the small hours beyond midnight, all of the ravages of the years and the storms and the worms came to a tremendous climax, and after the crash there was nothing left standing in the street, save 2 ancient chimneys and part of a stout brick wall. Nor did anything that had been alive come alive from the ruins. A poet and a traveler who came with the mighty crowd that sought the scene tell odd stories. The poet says that all through the hours before dawn he beheld sordid ruins indistinctly in the glare of the arc lights, that there loomed above the wreckage another picture, wherein he could describe moonlight and fair houses and elms and oaks and maples of dignity. And the traveler declares that Instead of the place's wonted stench, there lingered a delicate fragrance as of roses in full bloom. But are not the dreams of poets and the tales of travelers notoriously false? There may be those who say that things and places have souls, and there be those who say they have not, I dare say myself. But I have told you of the street. The End of the Street by H.P. Lovecraft.
H.P. Lovecraft has always inspired controversy in literary circles, more popular now than he ever was in his life, which, by the way, was relatively short. He was born in 1890 and only lived to be 47 years old. On the positive side, he is now an immensely influential author, pretty much pioneering the entire cosmic horror genre. You know, the view of a universe that is large and incomprehensible and probably just plain nasty. But others considered him to be a dreamy racist. That story that you just heard certainly could not be used as an argument against that notion. Interesting as it was to tell the life of a street, there were a lot of unpleasant stereotypes there. Of course, literary criticism is not what we're about here. I'm just trying to entertain you, and I hope you were entertained by that. Well, okay, that's the end of the show, and another 2 hours you'll never get back. I suppose I should play a little bit of Billy Mays' Rhapsody in Blue. See y'all next week, I hope.